it's totally normal to have a monetary budget. I mean, we may track calories, we may track money, but tracking carbon is so much harder for various reasons that we will discuss, right?
In this episode, we will discuss the book The Carbon Footprint of Everything by Mike Berners-Lee. We are focusing on the food industry and sustainability takeaways. Mike Berners-Lee is a professor and fellow of the Institute for Social Futures at Lancaster University in the UK. Most of the numbers that we talk about are based on consumption data from the UK, and we read the edition from 2022.
What the book already achieved with me is I have this carbon conscious after I've read it now.
Yes.
So that is a huge impact, because immediately when I go in the supermarket, I start checking out, where does it come from? Do I really need it? Is that in my carbon budget? We already started discussing that at home with my family, what impact the book is going to have on us.
My wonderful co-host for this season is Frank Kühne, Foundation Executive Board Member of the Adalbert Raps Foundation. The foundation funds applied food tech research. More on that later. Let's jump right in.
Yeah, I love that. And I also find that I've been a bit of a carbon hypocrite, because it did point out to me how bad flying is. And I'm aware of it, but I wasn't aware of the exact measures that one long haul flight could be half of one's allowed carbon budget for the year. And then if you go back and forth, here you just blew your entire budget.
Nothing more to eat for you.
Yeah.
That's
and
it.
Ciao.
Yeah,
no absolutely. More consumption for the rest of the year. Jeez. And also because it's worse if you have the emissions at a higher altitude. So the same emissions are worse if they're emitted
so?
Higher up in the sky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's closer to the sky and more harmful.
That's one of the reasons why carbon is often underestimated for air freight. And then another reason is that it's very hard to calculate all the indirect carbon emissions.
Yeah.
Because if you transport something, if you have a car, then it's not just the emissions that are being created on the ride, but all the emissions that were used to transport the aluminium and then produce it into a certain shape to make this piece of the car, and then the assembly of that. And if you think about all the steps that need to be calculated to get to the real measure of carbon equivalent, super hard.
It's very detailed. Absolutely. What I really started to think about is the 5-ton budget he explains to the reader as a necessity to achieve the 2.3 goal.
The Celsius goal.
To stay
at 2.3 Celsius increase in temperature.
I think that's such a low level. And even with such a low level, we are not achieving a super high goal. It's 2.3, and the impact of a 2.3 Celsius temperature increase is already quite severe. And that really made me think about how much we still need to achieve to reduce our footprint.
Yeah. Put into perspective, an average US person causes 21 tons a year, 4 times the budget. A UK person, 13 tons, and a Chinese person, 8 tons. So even in China, where you think people are living in the tiniest little spaces, still it's above the actual carbon budget. And it takes a lot to get down to that. And it takes reducing food emissions, but I think it also takes reducing overall emissions, of course, travel and luxuries, because everything has a certain value. We cannot eliminate food.
Yeah.
But we can eliminate some of the unnecessary purchases that we do in fancy luxury goods.
Okay. I know this might sound all very restricting, because it's pretty hard to stay within a 5-ton CO2 equivalent budget. It also sounds so long. But if the economy would switch to renewable energy and fossil-free transport, the carbon footprint of everything would reduce. Which also leads us to what we really need to refocus on in the food industry. It is important to address the challenges of animal agriculture, but if we want the food industry to be sustainable, we do also need to push for the adoption of renewable energy.
Yeah. Did you do the calculation? I think you did do the calculation of how much CO2 equivalent you can consume on a daily base if you try to work with those 5 tons as an annual budget.
Yeah, I found that in the book, he always keeps referring to the 5 tons. And then he also describes the different amounts of kilograms or grams that different foods cause. And I felt that it's a bit too broad, like I need a bit of a more concrete estimate. And so I broke it down into a weekly budget, assuming that a third of carbon expenses are food expenses, it would be 30 kilograms of CO2 a week. A vegan that doesn't eat anything that's flown in by plane and that doesn't waste food, that person gets to on average 17 kilograms a week. So that's great. But the average UK vegan already exceeds that. And then the average diet is nearly triple of that budget. So I was like, wow, it's really not that easy. It's quite an ambitious target. And then if you have just 200 grams of beef, you just blew nearly your entire week's budget with just a part of a meal. With just 200 grams of beef, that was pretty much all you were supposed to cause in terms of food carbon in a week.
So intermittent fasting gets a completely new thing.
Yeah. So it's like one piece of beef and then you fast for the rest of the week, then it's good.
Yeah. During my work in the area of food and specifically meat, we had several discussions on the term called Klimawore in Germany. What's a Klimawore?
This maybe is hard to understand. So this word comes from carnivore, someone who eats mostly meat, or omnivore, eating a mix of animal and plant-based foods, like most humans and dogs. And if you add climate to the front of it, it becomes a climavore.
And I understood climate warrior.
Warrior, like, yeah. No.
Guess I'm a climate warrior.
Warrior. No, talking about funny things, I always try to remember the carbon food with a D print and not the foot print. Let's talk about the carbon footprint. Yeah. Ta-ta. The carbon footprint.
Yeah.
But what I actually wanted to point out is there is already a subculture of people trying to eat more climate friendly because they think it's crucial.
Interesting, because you could also say it's a vegetarian climatarian.
Perhaps in 10 years, we're not measuring the ratio of vegan or vegetarian consumers, but we're going to measure like how many people do eat consciousness, climate consciousness.
Eat climate consciousness.
Okay, yeah.
I wonder what kind of dish that is.
And here, just a quick shout out to the Adalbert Raps Foundation, which has invested millions and millions into food science research. And that's also a great opportunity for startups and for researchers, for people who are working on their master thesis or their PhD thesis, or the next big idea that can turn the food system upside down in the positive sense. The Adalbert Raps Foundation is offering grants to scientific institutions, sometimes also working with startups. I've asked Frank what kind of topics they're actually offering grants for.
I think you can rule out anything which is nutrition. So any kind of consumer studies. We don't go out and because we don't believe that we have the knowledge to tell you what an entrepreneur or scientist should do. It should be the other way around. He should come to us because of his idea or her idea, his knowledge, and then basically say, look, that's something I want to achieve. So biggest headline is impact for us and not this or that topic we want to address. Changing the food system to a better food system.
Check out the Adalbert Raps Foundation by typing it into Google or by following the links in the show notes. You can also connect with Frank Alexander Kühne on LinkedIn and just ping him directly.
And by the way, let's actually circle back into what is carbon dioxide equivalent. So it's a measurement that looks at a 100-year span, methane is 28 times more potent, and nitrous oxide is 260 times more potent during this 100-year time frame. CO2 pretty much stays, methane does degrade, but because 100 years is a reasonable time frame to look at it, we talk about CO2 equivalent. Okay, so let's look at what makes food carbon intensive. If we have 1.5 kilograms of CO2 per meal, I really like the example of a strawberry oatmeal. So if you have a soy milk oatmeal with strawberries, you're perfectly in budget. We're perfectly on line with about 1 kilo of CO2 equivalent. But if these strawberries are air fried it, out of season from Mexico to New York, then they have 3 times higher emissions. And what I also loved is going by boat is actually pretty okay-ish. So every mile that the food would be transported by plane is about 100 times worse than if it would go by boat. So if your oranges are coming from pretty far away, but they're coming by boat, it's pretty carbon fine. Nothing is really carbon neutral except only if you have your tree in your garden and you eat the apple right from the tree. That is carbon neutral. It's going to be a long time.
Until you harvest your first apple, but it's true.
Yeah, otherwise everything has a carbon emissions attached to it. Everything has a price.
Everything has a price. That I actually was surprised about that because I would have thought there's going to be some kind of positive effect of growing a natural product on the field and by that catching carbon and then putting it into the earth and then producing a fruit. But still, with all the work going in and the transportation, the consumption, the preparation to consume it, still adds CO2 equivalent.
Also, oftentimes it comes up the good beef, right? The idea of beef sequestering so much carbon that it's actually climate positive beef. And it's one thing is like, first, I mean, you don't need to use cows for regenag necessarily. You can also use other animals that are a bit smaller and aren't ruminants. And to make the worst climate polluting animal suddenly the savior, that seems to me a bit of a stretch. I know you are a bit more open to that.
Oh, that's a tough question. Yes, I tend to eat meat. I even did a TED talk about that. I think I have learned to be a lot more conscious about this. If I eat twice a month a piece of meat, that would be a lot. I wouldn't buy a cattle grown in the United States and mass farming and then enjoy the steak. I'd rather have a more local grass-fed cattle milk cow. I just want to say, please don't hate me for that. Don't unsubscribe from Marina because of what I've just said. Yeah. Perhaps in a certain way, I'm like a model about the way people struggle with getting away from meat and to do it better. And sometimes it's harder to do something better. But there's a chance of change and there's the possibility of change.
Yeah. But then the irony is, and that's also something that he points out in the book, that actually if you would do animal farming in the most carbon efficient way, it would be cram them all together as tightly as possible. Don't let them move because that would burn calories, which would require more feed, and just try to grow them as fast as possible.
Did you see the post a couple of weeks ago? It was last week with this Chinese pig growing factory where they have crammed 100,000 pigs in one place. It's supposed to be the most efficient pig growing house. Skyscraper.
Wow.
In China.
It's a pig skyscraper.
It's a pig skyscraper. Yeah, you can
find
that.
Funny. That's funny in a horrible way.
I'm not quite sure if China does that because they want to have a climate positive impact. I think it's more about a cost impact, but still, so there are these. We're not theoretically talking about these things. And I think you actually can say, honestly, if you look in some setups here, even in Europe, they are, in that regard, very efficient setups for growing animals.
This is actually a very fascinating point. In a study by Joseph Poor from Oxford University in 2020, he argues that it's actually important to have national-specific recommendations for dietary guidelines. So beef from South America can be 4 to 5 times worse than beef from Europe. It's using way more land and water. And also, inside regions, it can vary widely. For example, UK-grown beef is much less emitting than French beef. And that can be due to regulation, culture, and generally farming practices. So is grass-fed beef the solution? Also very complicated, because grass-fed cows gain weight more slowly and produce more methane because they eat grass. This may be balanced for a while with the cow's restoration of soil health. However, as also the author Mike Berners-Lee points out, the soil can only store a certain amount of carbon, and then it plateaus. So it's not enough to long-term offset the methane emissions of cows, who are unfortunately the highest emitting livestock animals. Globally, we have more livestock than wild animals. So regenerative agriculture can be and is an important part of the solution. But if somebody says we need more cows for sustainability, I think we have enough. We can use the ones that we have.
But I think it's not the only perspective you can actually tackle. And climate is not the only thing you should measure your actions on, or climate protection. And I agree absolutely with you. There's the animal welfare. Like, what is the animal doing there and how does it feel? There's a social impact on it. Did you really find that in his book, that he pointed out all these different areas you need to look at?
No, that's what I personally missed. I think, to me, one of the most important areas to look at is nitrogen and phosphor contamination. Yeah. If you look at the 9 planetary boundaries, I can very much recommend Googling this, the 9 planetary boundaries, the Lancet report. We can see that actually, in terms of nitrogen and phosphor contamination, we are far over the planet's boundaries. So we should cut our use of fertilizer drastically and also find ways to remove already leaked nitrogen from the groundwater, from dead zones in the ocean, etc. He does point out, for example, that rice is super carbon intensive. On the one hand, it has methane bubbling up from flooded paddy fields, but it's ridiculous that 3 tons of rice are produced using 1 ton of fertilizer. What kind of ratio is that? Imagine you would do that to your houseplant. Like, if a third of the weight of your houseplant would be just fertilizer.
Fertilizer. That's bizarre, actually, yeah.
Yeah. And then you have a big houseplant and it's just like you're putting bottles and bottles of fertilizer on it. And China uses 4 times as much fertilizer per acre as the global average. And look, it's easy to blame, but yeah, they have to feed a population with very little arable land and with growing issues like heavy metal contamination, droughts here, floods there, etc. And they are very much pushed to get as much out of every hectare as possible.
I did a journey to China about 4 or 6 years ago, visiting the garlic fields of China. They're actually the biggest tomato producers, just as a side information. Garlic is huge in China too. You drive on a well-built road and you drive 50 kilometers and it's flat land and it's garlic. Field after field, and every kilometer or so you see some trees growing up, so they're going to break up the wind, so it's not going to be too heavy on the soil, so the erosion is not too strong, and it's just field after. And every 20 or 25 kilometers you see a village where they do the harvesting and the collecting.
Wow.
Bring it to a factory. That's intense. It's high industry, big volume, huge scale ups, monocultures. That was perhaps the even more shocking, was monoculture. It's just garlic. Kilometer.
Endless garlic. Yeah. He does mention the question of carbon to taste ratio, and especially when he talks about hothouses. So that's what he calls greenhouses, which are growing produce out of season, therefore requiring heating. if you would just eat for as a meal 1 kilo of tomatoes, if you really feel like having tomatoes today, it would be totally fine. You're in budget. But if those would be 1 kilo of organic vine cherry tomatoes from a heated greenhouse in Ohio in March, this 1 kilo would be 54 kilograms of CO2 equivalent. That is like just blew your budget for the entire week nearly twice.
Yeah.
And it comes down to the heating. Greenhouses should actually utilize the sun, make it more efficient. But in that case, it makes it so much worse.
Yeah. And I always wonder when we talk about that greenhouse topic, all the investments going into urban or vertical farming around the moment, where people are promising a more efficient production of green leaves or fruits and tomatoes, even tomatoes. I hardly can imagine that they have a lower carbon footprint than some tomato grown in season on the field, produced by the sun.
Yeah. With vertical farming, we cannot talk about it as a general topic, but it's really a case-by-case decision where you put this vertical farm and for what purpose. Are there good alternatives that are actually also climate resistant around? Is it in a water scarce environment that's very hot and that would really benefit from reducing water use?
I was just wondering, either you do an air freight strawberry, was the example we were using, from Mexico in winter for your Christmas feast, or would you rather have a greenhouse heated vertical farming facility in Germany in winter delivering your strawberries? I think both are wrong. Yeah, and that's what he says in his books. Both are wrong because you should choose seasonal fruits. But
if we would have to.
You have to choose.
I'm not even sure we can make that judgment here because vine cherry tomatoes. He also says that the specialized tomatoes, if you have these small, tasty tomatoes, they are more carbon intensive because they are less efficient to grow. And that makes them also so heavy. That would have been an example in the book that I really missed. Like, he doesn't directly compare those two options with the same piece of food.
Perhaps it's important information. He is a UK-based scientist. So he looks quite a lot from the UK perspective on the market. And I think there's a lot more products being flown into Great Britain than the typical continental European consumer perhaps is using.
Yeah. He mentioned with the cherry tomatoes, carbon emissions per unit of taste. Yeah, we need to always consider what is the input, what are the resources used, but what is the benefit? So I think if one wants to indulge, it's probably better to indulge in carbon intensive food than it is to indulge in some kind of unnecessary luxury watch, like a fifth watch in one's collection. Because food, that's a necessity. You will have to eat either way.
I'm still wondering about the measure, because there's a different value in calories when you eat orange, or a kilogram of asparagus has a different density of energy than 200 gram of beef. And I was wondering if it would be a good step to move into that direction where you actually say use a different unit to compare these things, which would make it a lot easier.
And I guess it comes back to thinking of it as a meal, right? And is it worth it in terms of the protein that you get, the fiber content, the vitamins, the freshness, the taste, and then trying to balance it. And I think in the West, we're all consuming way too much protein. We're not those high-powered athletes that always need to make sure that we have our protein intake over the top. If you think about how many people go to the doctor for protein deficiency, that's not a thing. Think about how many people go for fiber deficiency. I'm sorry for making this comment, but fiber over protein, unclog the nation, people, okay? Please. This is, in terms of nutrition, a more important issue.
I totally agree. Specifically, if you look at the United States or Europe in general, totally. But I think what the point you're touching here is, first of all, is the calories the right unit? And then some people would think, well, what about the nutritional value of the product that should be the right unit? These kind of discussions make it not manageable as a consumer, as a human being trying to protect the world. You rather say, oh, I can't do anything because I don't know what the right thing is.
Yeah.
I've always been afraid of that kind of discussion.
I like what Mike refers to as the carbon instinct. He says we have a price instinct. We know that this banana is going to cost less than an avocado and that a fish is going to be more pricey than the avocado. Creating this kind of gut instinct is what I think this book is really also about. And in general, plant-based foods are a safe bet. Less processed is probably also a good idea. And then the ways to go about it are no air fried, ideally somewhat local-ish to avoid air fried. But sometimes, even if it's transported from afar, like oranges, it can still be good if it came by boat, better than if it would have been grown locally in a hothouse.
He had this thumb rule where he says anything that has a hard skin, which is well protected for transportation, that could be an indication that it's a ship-transported product. The more fragile the product is, the fresher the product is, the more you risk to be air fried, even if it's not labeled.
And then also an important part of it is food waste. One thing that I realized after we did our season on food waste, one of the takeaways for me was really you need to stop it as soon as possible. So if these apples are lost and just put right into the earth, that's sad, but it's not as bad as if they would have been shipped or transported to the distributor, then to the wholesaler, then put on sale at the retailer, been picked up by a car, put into the fridge, and just rot away silently until they're thrown into the trash. By that time, it's like the apple is accumulating carbon.
What are you trying to say? If you're going to shop the next time, buy the old, crumbled, wrinkled apple instead of the shiny, glossy new product?
I mean, if you want to be a food warrior or a climate warrior.
Climate warrior, yeah.
When I started dating my partner, the first time I went to his place, I saw the most crumbly, raisin apple I've seen in years. I was like, oh my God, what are you doing? Throw it away. It has absolutely zero vitamin C in it anymore. And he's like, no, I'm seriously going to eat it. And he did. And I was shocked. I was so shocked, but also impressed.
It's very impressive.
That's why I'm together with him. So let's look into carbon offsets briefly. What's interesting is he talks about marine planting. Seagrass only covers 0.2% of the seafloor, but it absorbs about 10% of the ocean's carbon each year. And the second one is soil carbon sequestration. So we all know that from regenerative agriculture, which is when you store carbon in the soil by avoiding tilling, by looking out for the soil health. And we will do a season on this at some point. But there he says it's limited. I would need to have 5 hectares of regenerative farmland to just offset my own ideal carbon footprint. And then the third thing is biochar, which is spreading charcoal on fields to capture carbon and also enhance soil fertility. So there's a startup called Puro Earth that does that. You'll find it in the show notes. And there's also a cool startup in soil carbon sequestration called CLIM.
In an interview, Mike was asked, where does he think the biggest leverage is in the food industry? And pointed out that he thinks the food service area is a huge leverage for him because you have a limited number of people you need to educate in a way to be more carbon conscious. And they're not only being able to have a big influence on the supply chain they're using for the products, they have a big influence of the culinary products they are offering to their customers. They are able to educate a lot of people to eat tasteful food, likable food, and not only food which is good for the climate. When he was asked in the interview, I think, great idea. I really like this approach. Let's see where most of the people come together. They don't eat at home on their own. They tend to be in cantinas, in restaurants, fast food chains. and give them a different offer.
Yeah, in the food waste season, we had Winnow on. Winnow is a AI system that analyzes what food is thrown away in the hospitality sector and then helps the teams to recognize, okay, you just have been throwing away on average 100 liters of fish soup a day. Apparently, people don't like fish soup as much as you think. So do less of it and come up with all these innovative ways of reducing their food waste. For me, one of the important parts is looking at who's in a power position, and retailers are in a strong power position. So retailers could educate people on what is in season. You can have a poster at the entrance of the supermarket, or even better, in the grocery aisle where people choose the vegetables, showing them this is in season, or just have even an entire aisle just for produce that's in season. And one thing that he includes in the book is air freight labels, which I think would also make a lot of sense.
I always wonder, when coming from the industry, I think that's the blame game. Is it the consumer making the decisions and by that influencing what the industry offers or the retail offers, or is it the industry offering a certain product to the consumer and by that helping him to choose the right product? I always struggle to find the right approach here. I see the responsibility on both sides.
Yeah.
Perhaps my industry friends won't like it, but I think sometimes that calls for legislation, putting pressure on the industry and the retailer to have a standard solution for these kind of topics. Like most of us as a consumer tend to look for taste than price, and perhaps even price more important than taste. And that's something the industry is obviously trying to deliver for us. There's one retailer putting out a poster. The next one is trying to avoid those costs and then pushing the consumer into the direction, buy the cheaper product, buy the asparagus from Chile, which is in sale.
Yeah, which in the end, sometimes values need to find their way back into business. So I think it changes if certain people in the right positions say, come on, that's really a small thing that we can do. And the other thing is, like, I agree, legislation is sometimes just the easiest way to go about it. And when labeling actually was mandated in the 60s by the USDA, then all food products had to start listing ingredients. The nutrition labeling only came in the 70s. Now, it would be so weird to go into a supermarket and there's just no nutrition labeling on all the processed foods. We got so used to it. Why would it be impossible to add a carbon label?
Shall we open up the arena? Being from the industry, I know the struggle we're having with all these things and the cost being involved to do that properly. Very challenging. Just, I agree with you. And I think as long as it is a general rule, let's go for it. But it's not just collect the data. It needs to be produced. It needs to be put in a database. It needs to be followed through the whole supply chain in the company and then put on the label and verified.
Yeah.
So it's not a zero cost project, I think. And that's where we end up again. Is the consumer willing to pay more for that?
Yeah, of course. It needs to then be necessary for everybody. If you direct the decisions based on carbon, it's good to measure it because it becomes something that decisions can be based on.
I totally agree.
Just, is it a must read, Frank?
No, it's enough if you listen to our podcast.
Very good. I'll give you the $20 later.
Yeah, great. Now, I think it's definitely a book you should have a look into it. I think I would put it in the other way. Is there a way to build up a carbon conscious, as he asks you? And I would say that's a pretty good chance to build up that consciousness.
Yeah.
Yourself?
I think we covered a lot. I would still say it could be a good read to just skip through it and get a few more examples. Keeping 30 kilograms per week and 1.5 kilograms of CO2 equivalent a meal in mind.
Here are some more takeaways from the book that we didn't get to. One thing that really stuck with me is that even without fancy fracking technologies, we will exceed 4 degrees Celsius. The world's known and available fossil fuel supplies are enough to tip the world into total chaos. And this is so shocking to me because it made it really clear that there's no natural limit. The solution needs to come from strong, fast legislation, us changing our behavior and demanding better from governments and business, and some freaking miracle technocratic solution as well. Another fascinating and worrying point related to that is how right-wing extremism is connected to fossil fuels. So where fossil fuel fascism and eco-fascism emerge, it is a very dangerous spiral in which climate breakdown causes mass migration and therefore increases xenophobia. This is an interesting theory, and I know this is a bit edgy, but it's economically easier to blame immigrants and to divert attention from the actual issue, which is the climate breakdown and fossil fuels. I will link to a fantastic explanation of fossil fuel fascism and eco-fascism in the show notes. I know we are getting a little bit out of the classic food tech talk here, but I do believe it's very important for us to zoom out once in a while and think about the grand context in which we are operating. Because as long as we are fossil fuel dependent, the industry will stay notoriously unsustainable. Here's a quote from the book that I also found fascinating. If we got rid of bottled water, people would be financially better off, but the economy would look as though it had slowed down a fraction. This is a nice illustration of how inadequate it is to measure how we are doing solely in terms of our economic growth. Another interesting point is about offsetting. So Mike Berners-Lee writes, offsetting is a seductive concept, especially when it is offered at prices as low as $4 per ton of CO2 equivalent. This would work out to $48 per year for the average US citizen to offset all their carbon use and solve their carbon conscience. At that rate, the whole climate crisis could be solved for a trivial 0.2% of the world's GDP. The only genuine offset is to remove CO2 or other greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. These negative emissions are really expensive, and their technologies are mainly in their infancy. So this is what you will find if you look up carbon capture storage, which is different from carbon capture utilization, where you just use the carbon, but it's not stored permanently. Thank you for listening to Red to Green. A special thanks to the audio editors of this episode. Check out the team on our website, redtogreen.solutions. Until next time, let's move the food industry from harmful to healthy, from polluting to sustainable, from red to green.